Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Nick Bantock, who reads from and discusses his new novel, Windflower, published by Chronicle. In the weeks to come, we have Alan Folsom, Chris Hedges, Kimberly Stewart, Sophie Kinsella, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, I'd like to both welcome you and thank you for supporting independent bookselling. Our guest this evening elevated the art of the book, and he has transported readers to enchanting, extraordinary places with his vision as an author and an illustrator. The Griffin and Sabine novels soared onto the bestseller list and enjoyed that throne for over 100 weeks, while we all had the immense pleasure of their pages and, of course, come on, admit it, had the sheer thrill of reading someone else's mail. With his newest creation, Windflower, Nick Bantock extends another invitation of allurement, this time a journey of personal discovery for a woman who is promised in marriage to a man she doesn't love. Myth and intrigue are accompanied by Nick's dreamlike images, images that seem to flow on the page bottom and form, in his word, quote, a stream of unconsciousness. We are delighted that he was able to reschedule his visit to the Tattered Cover after being snowed in up in his home in Vancouver this last November. We're delighted to welcome him back to Denver. Please give a warm welcome to Nick Bantock. Thank you.
Okay, the first bit is always the hardest bit, right? We've got to make eye contact and make sure we actually like each other. To an extent, anyway. So let's just pretend, right? Let's pretend that we've got through the first 10 minutes and our nervousness is over. You know, it's not a one-night stand, so maybe it is, but... So the first thing I need to know, just to help me, is who knows my books? Okay, so that leaves a few. Who doesn't? Who has absolutely no idea what I do? Well, that's fine. Now, first of all, you have to tell me where you dragged tears screaming. Would you rather be somewhere else? You tell the truth. No, okay, that's all right. There's usually some, you know, it's usually a guy who sits there, you know, like his head's down in his shoulders, and you tell he's really miserable. Okay, this is different for me because this is the very first time I've sat up here at any podium this particular tour, and I haven't done many cities this time, without a copy of Griffin and Sabine in front of me. And it's really, in some ways, I try and put the first 10 minutes over, or 5 minutes, or maybe even 30 seconds, over to, if you like, putting it to bed. So before we start on the Windflower, does anyone have any questions about Griffin and Sabine? They can be big questions. The big questions I'll probably skirt round, but you know. Okay, starting then.
Is anybody real?
Are any of us real? I don't it's too big a philosophy for me to get with. I got asked a similar question last night in Portland. It came in the form of, well, can you explain the end of the last book? I would say it's very difficult because our society has thinks very much in terms of black and white. And these books are about two, three, four, or five things going on at once. So to say it is this or it is that would be to cut something off that might equally be true. And I'm not dodging the issue. I really mean that each person has to find where they are on the various levels. And it's been my experience that people have gone back to the books after, you know, 2 years or 5 years and said it was like, you know, looking at something completely different because their own life experience had given them a totally different interpretation. Well, I certainly don't want to rob that possibility. I will say this, that the first three books, essentially what I had in my mind was about showing the relationship of male and female, not men and women, but male and female, both internally and externally. the second three books, if that was the microcosm, the second three books were the macrocosm. I was trying to show the relationship between a greater sense of consciousness, the fact that we are always all struggling with that inclination to fall asleep, and that we are encouraged intensely by the corporations, by the politicians, and by whoever else wants us to buy something or think a certain thing to fall asleep. So our job, as I see it, and my job specifically in what I do, is to try and do the reverse, to wake people up. And the way I've chosen to do that, and I've chosen to do it because I just simply like doing it, is bringing together the world of imagery and the world of text and trying to marry them, trying to show that images are not necessarily illustrations, that images have their own right. They stand equally with words. If you think how we all began, we stood up on our hind legs, we started to move around. We didn't start speaking and trying to organize each other. The first thing we did was to perceive the world. So our dream life and our waking life were built of the same building bricks. Once we started to create words, little by little, those words actually, and the use of those words, particularly once a patriarchal society started, and it was used as a form of manipulation, as mode of communication, it drove a wedge between the world of logic and the world of intuition. That's why intuition is so put down. It's so mistrusted. But when you think, what is intuition? Intuition is simply thinking in pictures without translating it back into words as you go along. If you have an image in a dream, it moves to another image and another image and another image. And by the end of the night, you've accumulated or used up a vast quantity of information. But that's that. If you are translating that into words, as we do in our daily life when we are trying to communicate, or often now even in our thinking patterns, where we feel that we have to constantly justify the things that we instinct, it slows the process down to a grinding place where we can be, as George Orwell would suggest in 1984, manipulated very easily, because you take away people's capacity to think, you take away their capacity to articulate, you shrink their language. And I think the latest survey had it that the average North American vocabulary was down to 800 words. That is truly scary. And if you think at least 93 of those are like... Will Shakespeare's vocabulary was 20,000 if you take his plays. We do have a battle on our hands. So I see that as a two-way battle. One is to bring back language as best we can, and the second is to be fully conscious of our capacity to use our intuition and trust it through our understanding of imagery. And our understanding of imagery means that we have to be re-educated. We have to re-educate ourselves into seeing, not simply swallowing what we are given. That's why I talk to the TV all the time. Not because I believe anyone is listening, because it's an antidote. It's like when you have too much noise coming in, you find yourself humming just to know you're actually there. So I talk to the television just to make sure that it doesn't slip that little subliminal through and have a little go at me. Speaking of subliminal, and I may go back to this later if anyone asks, what I've tried to do in Windflower is, whereas with Griffin and Sabine and all my other books, the images are there, you read, you stop, you look at the pictures, you go back to the text. That's a process of moving from left brain to right brain, getting people exercised from going side to side, including me whilst I'm doing it. But in this book, I try to do something slightly different. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, but at least I tried. I tried to tell a story that is in a text form that flows through, but the images run hopefully in the same way that information passes into the subconscious. In other words, it's images by peripheral vision. They are intentionally soft. The actual figurative elements do not relate to the images on the page. Because as in a dream, we dream about the past, we juggle it, we sometimes maybe even have precognitive, but we certainly move around with dreams as images, as symbols and elements. So what I've tried to do in this book is to create this peripheral underworld that hopefully speaks to the subconscious in its own language, but at the same time, it actually forces that recognition of things past and things to come. Time past and time present are the same in time future. I think that was Eliot, wasn't it? Was it anyone know? Anyway. So maybe any more Griffin and Sabine before I go on? Well, we can always come back to it. I don't mind that much. Just next time I come, I don't want to hear the words. Let me tell you a little bit about how this book came to be. I had the idea for... I wanted to write something about love and the notion that love... There are so many different kinds of love. And my first thought was maybe if I could have one character run it through their life and have her experience a number of different kinds of love. It seemed a little too literal. It seemed a little prosaic. So I put the idea on one side. Then I had another idea about trying to create that magical world of mythology where the gods and the mortals interact. But the gods in mythology always behave badly, whether it's Hindu or Greek or whatever. They're never what they should be, well, the way we would like them to be. So that is an essential part of enjoyable mythology. So that started me down another track. They started to veer together as ideas. And then one day I had a call from an old friend, Eduardo Ponti, who was in Vancouver with his first film. And he asked me if I'd go and see it and go to the reception. Afterwards, we started talking about what he was going to do next. And he said he wanted to do a love story. And he asked me, did I have any ideas? And suddenly this jumped into my head, this idea of different kinds of love. So instead of him talking to all these people that he was meant to talk to, we ended up rapping for the next 2 hours about love. Bottom of the day, we agreed to email each other with a continuation of this idea. And before we knew it, we were actually working on the film script. We went to Barcelona, where we imagined would be a nice base for this story. Not a real Barcelona, nor a current Barcelona, but a city not unlike a combination of Barcelona and maybe Algeria, possibly somewhere in the 1920s. So we came back, we went down to Los Angeles, we sat and we started writing. I started writing and from the ideas. And then I stopped and I said, we've got too many ideas. And we agreed that the very best thing to do was if I go away and I write the book, and then when the book's finished, I hand it to him, and then he will write the film script. Well, that was meant to be. It was meant to take a year, but that was 3 years ago. I mean, I hate books like this. I'm so used to hitting deadlines. Anyway, I finally did finish it. But meanwhile, he's had his first child, and the film industry is in a very different place. So who knows whether it will ever be made as a film. I'm so cynical of Hollywood. I mean, I've been dealing with those fruitcases down there for 16 years now. I was just saying earlier on, I must have seen 30-odd scripts for various of my books. I've been to God knows how many meetings. Not one of them has ever got past first base. It's not remotely like actually becoming a film. The whole thing is a joke. But anyway, they pay me. So as you can see, I'm hugely philosophical about this. And if it becomes a film, that's great. If it doesn't, well, the book's here. Once I started to write the book myself, it became in some ways much easier. I would send Eduardo and my editor every sort of a third or chapter or so. I'd send them, and then they just, you know, send me back with a little bit of feedback, and then I'd, you know, go on my merry way. My experience of publishing is really interesting. In all the books I've done, I have never once had anyone come back with any remote criticism about any of the art. You know, it's like I could do almost anything, and they say, yeah, fine, fine, fine. In fact, they don't even want to see the art until the book is virtually finished. But they will argue till the cows come home about whether there should or shouldn't be a comma before or after any given conjunction. It's unbelievable. Anyway, I just whatever they decide, I go along with it. Because I'm not a writer. And I'm not really. I finally decided that I'm faking it, because I don't honestly think you can be both. You can write, but if you start out as a painter, that's what you are. And finally come to that conclusion. I mean, I painted, you know, seriously. I went to art college when I was 15. That's what I did. I came out after 5 years. I survived as a painter. I started doing book covers. I started doing books of my own. I came up with the idea of Griffin and Sabine. I didn't remotely imagine that I would be the one to write it. They bullied me into doing it. Not really. They just said they thought I could do it, so I did. But I enjoy it. But you know, imagine if you get to the age of 40 and you haven't written a word, because what your English teacher said to you when you were 15 is the best thing you can do for humanity is never pick up a pen again. You're inclined to believe that. So anyway, so they tell me I'm a writer. What I am really is a mongrel. I'm a sort of like a half and half creature that actually has found this peculiar middle place where I function very, very comfortably. And you know, I'm quite happy to be here. Okay, the story. It is impossible, I think, to, when you do a reading, to really say too much about a book. I've seen the mistake, what I consider a mistake, of many authors having gone to other people's readings where they will sit down and they will read, like they will start and they will read for 40 minutes. You know, you can't stay, no matter how good a reader they are. Possibly maybe John le Carré could do it, but very, very few. So I've come to the conclusion that the best thing to do is to just give you little tasters. So I'm going to give you three little tasters from this book. Anna, the young girl who is the heroine, she is a gypsy dancer. Her people have stagnated, been in the same place for 30-odd years. She believes, her grandfather believes, that there is a dance, that if she could discover how to dance this dance, she would free her people and be able to lead them back on the road, which is their rightful place. But her parents want her to be married to confirm the position in the valley. She runs away. The story begins when she runs away from her marriage. She goes to this place called Serona. There she meets four men, four unusual men, who surround and swirl around her. Each one is clearly trying to seduce her in his own way, in a very different way, you know, quite possibly with different ends, quite possibly with the same ends in mind. The journey that we take in going through this book is seeing her dealing with these men, and at the same time her struggle to find not only her art, but her art represented in the Spanish sense of duende, the art that will free her soul, free her voice, free her body in the flamenco sense, and through so doing be able to go to her people and show them. The first piece I'm going to read is with Anna, and Anna has just lost her dance teacher before she even gets him. He refuses her. One of these men is teaching her to dance a particular dance. His name is Sirocco. Anna, try to keep your head and shoulders still. Move your hips independently. Did he mean independently from my head and shoulders or independently from each other? Maybe he meant both. Ever since my dancing had become stuck, Sirocco had taken it upon himself to tutor me. This was not something he discussed. It had simply become inevitable. Initially, it had been wonderful to have someone serious and well-versed in musical rhythms who was willing to direct me. But now I was beginning to feel unsure of where he was taking me. I stopped. What's the matter? He was sitting on the floor, drums between his knees, his shirt undone to the waist, and his loose trouser legs rolled to his calves. For over an hour he'd been trying to teach me a dance employed by an oasis tribe reputedly able to bewitch anyone who watched them. But the sensuality of the movements was making me feel self-conscious. Maybe I'm thinking too much. This all feels so strange to me. I was hot and frustrated. I worked my neck from side to side, trying to loosen the growing tightness in my back. It's bound to, he replied. You cannot expect to learn to dance from the inside until you control the outside. Your stance is too high. Try again. Bend your knees and lower your center of gravity. Flatten your soles to the ground. It was the third time in the last 10 minutes he'd told me that. But even though the position increased my stability, I repeatedly found myself reverting to the balls of my feet. I tried again, but again I stopped. I'm sorry, but I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be doing, Sirocco. This feels like some kind of fertility ritual. Of course it feels that way. It is fertile. You want the earth to teach you, but you're not willing to let it in. The dance you seek demands that you spread yourself. Only when you open to the rhythm will you be able to seduce. Seduce? What do you mean? My response was abrupt and filled with suspicion. How else do you think you will win over your tribe? He said, brushing aside my defenses. All leaders seduce their followers. Do you imagine they will put their faith in an inexperienced girl? No, of course not. But I can promise they will follow to the ends of the earth a woman who embodies all the passion they are unable to summon within themselves. As long as you are frightened by your own power, you will never convince anyone to follow you. The words shocked me, but I knew they contained a hard truth. The journey I'd embarked upon was not for the weak or the half-hearted. I took a deep breath and let it out slowly. Sirocco tapped out a rhythm. Now, Anna, consider the ground your drum. Dance. He banged harder. I closed my eyes and tried to beat the arches of my feet into the tiles. I wanted to crush my inhibitions. Faster, he demanded. Good, keep going. My ankles were hurting. He kept on drumming. What you want will always be beyond the corner of your eye. Let it go. I was near exhaustion when it happened. Something changed. I had the strangest sensation that I was no longer the dancer, but the dance itself. Yes. Yes, he called out, still pounding relentlessly on the little drums. My legs were rubbery, but my body kept going. I was dancing closer to him, now only a few feet away. I was turning my body inside out, and he was watching me intently. His hands held the drums, and the drums clutched at me. My hem was also almost touching his face. My head was thrown back, and then I looked up and saw a pigeon, black against the glass ceiling of the Cartarossa. My arms dropped to my side and my feet stopped moving. There was something not right. It wasn't the right place, nor was it the right time. I looked down at Sirocco. He was watching me placidly. The drums were silent. Gone was his fervour. And for a second, I wondered if I'd imagined the look I'd seen on his face just a few moments earlier. I have an appointment, I said, my heart galloping. I must go. It's hard writing from the point of view of a woman. I'm a geezer. So what I try and do is I try and talk to my, you know, all the women I know, and try and remember every conversation I've had with women to try and pull in anything that will help me. And as I was about to write this next piece, I suddenly remembered something that I'd heard in conversation with a couple of women. One had been talking, I won't tell you about the conversation. I'll simply read the piece, and then at the end of the piece, you will see the piece that inspired it. Just to let fill you in, this is with one of the other men. This is Mr. Hamatan. He's slightly older. He's very astute. He's fascinated by water, particularly instruments, that water instruments that he builds himself, one of which is made from water pipes. And he has this, he takes Anna to this huge great arboretum, this big glass arboretum with tropical plants. And inside it is an old Moorish bathhouse. And he's redesigned the water pipes not only to keep the bathhouse going and to keep the tropical plants going, but also to make music. He fiddles with the dials. So he's just shown Anna an example of this water orchestra. When the music had subsided to a series of gurglings, they wandered back to the room with the main bath, where Anna admired the pale blue and rose frescoed walls, the hanging baskets, the exquisite circular bath with its dark ultramarine tiles. The pool must have been at least 10 arms span in diameter. There was something immensely inviting about the still water, and Anna became acutely aware of her clammy skin. She was about to remark on the perfect calmness of the scene when Mr. Hamatan started taking his clothes off. He was chatting away over his shoulder, still talking about pipes and their tones, as he placed his garments on the wooden bench next to the pile of folded towels. When he was completely naked, he descended the tiled steps into the water. Anna was lost for words, or even thoughts, but Mr. Hamatan seemed to be totally devoid of embarrassment. "Are you not coming in? The water's warm, but it feels refreshingly cool compared to the air temperature." She stared at him in astonishment. What was he doing? Was he trying to lure her into the pool to seduce her? Perhaps he was an exhibitionist. But why then would he be so nonchalant? Anna's mind was racing. She thought of the foot massage Mr. Hamatan had given her. Suddenly she wasn't sure if his actions had been as innocent as they'd seemed. She didn't want to misinterpret the implications of his offer one way or the other. "Thanks," she stammered. "I'll just stay here and stand guard." "You don't have to be concerned. This is not a public day," he said reassuringly. Had he truly misunderstood her, or was he playing the serpent? Maybe she should leave, but she had to admit the water did look tempting. She was boiling. Could she simply undress and climb in? "Thank you, no," she said. "Maybe next time." She knew her answers sounded feeble, but she didn't know what else to say. And she didn't know where to look. Despite herself, her eyes were drawn to the spectacle of Mr. Hamatan, who was obviously enjoying his bath. He picked up a long-handled brush and scrubbed his back vigorously. He seemed remarkably youthful, his back strong and powerful, and Anna found herself wondering again how old he was. There was a shaft of light coming through the dome window that reflected off his radiant skin, and for a moment he looked almost godlike. Anna couldn't stop staring at him. She realized she'd never fully looked at a naked man before. She'd seen from a distance the occasional unclothed body washing itself at the camp's pump, but she'd never let herself look properly. Even with Boreas, she hadn't felt assured enough to step back and take him in. Watching Mr. Hamatan flexing, stretching, and bending at the mundane task of cleansing himself, Anna felt a distinct sensation of pleasure. It wasn't exactly a sexual feeling, though that too hovered in the background. It was more of an acknowledgement, an appreciation. If only she possessed his calm, she wouldn't be scared of failing. She wanted the patience that he seemed to carry within. If when she was dancing, she could maintain that kind of stillness. Maybe it would counterbalance her tendency to overextend. Anna sat a little straighter, no longer furtive in her examination. If she had been able to make time stand still, she would have waded into the water and washed him herself, let her hands soap his body, examining the soft, the hard, the rough, the smooth, all of the shapes and all of the angles. Possibly she would have been tempted further, but that wasn't the point of the matter. What satisfied Anna was that she felt grown up enough to take delight in something that was so pleasing to her eye. But she didn't plunge into the water. Mr. Hamerton's interpretation of such an act was not something she was willing to deal with. The only thing she could do was what she was doing already, observe him. He stayed in the pool for about 5 minutes, and then he got out, rubbed himself dry with one of the large white towels. Once dressed, he looked at her rather gravely. In my country, men and women bathe together. I confess that in my state of musical euphoria, I was not thinking clearly. It has only just dawned on me that not every culture accepts public nakedness between sexes. I do hope I didn't offend you. No, not at all, said Anna. Then more bravely, you have a good, strong body. You are very kind. I'm sure if you'd join me in the bath, I would be complimenting you in return. The thought of Mr. Hamerton looking at her as explicitly as she had looked at him made Anna flush. Why was it, she asked herself, that it seems easier to make love with a man than have another study her nakedness? It didn't make sense, and yet it was undoubtedly true. And so I want to come to later in the book. This is the last piece I'll read. People are always asking, is it okay to take ideas from elsewhere? As far as I'm concerned, absolutely. It's how you do it, with what self-knowledge you do it. And Picasso said, I'll steal from anyone but myself. A great idea. I mean, far too many artists just copied themselves towards their later life and became chocolates boxy. Chagall, for example. Any Chagall lovers? I'm sorry, but it's true. There are two aspects in here of this book where I clearly know that I took inspiration from elsewhere. One is earlier on, there is a speech from a character who, in my mind, is Garcia Lorca-esque. Lorca gave a speech in Cuba talking about duende. Do you know duende? Have you heard of the word? It's a Spanish word which means the passion of creativity that comes up through the soles of your feet and pours out through your hands or your mouth or your body. There is no real Western equivalent. I wanted to express some of what Lorca expressed in this speech. But you can't just take it and plonk it in. So I tried to reword it and then reword it and rewrite it and rewrite it, always moving away from what his original words were, but at the same time try and keep the essence of what it meant for me. And then at the end of it, the place that he delivers the speech in this imaginary island that she goes to is the Café Artístico, which the name of the café in Cuba where Lorca gave his original speech was the Café Artístico. So what I hopefully it's doing is saying, I acknowledge Lorca's place in this, I give homage and move on. So that's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is this next piece is where you just simply, you read something and the mood hit you so powerfully that this is the way to deal with a certain situation. And so when I had to write this piece, what came into my head was King Lear, when he's totally frustrated and outraged and he stands on the hill and he's just raging at the universe. And that was the image that was just pouring through me as I started to write this. I was alone and I danced. I did not need to watch or listen to the raging firmament. I knew that I had been forgotten in their violent sibling dispute. They were of no concern to me. They had betrayed me, and I held them in contempt. They spat and lashed from north to south, east to west, and back again. They rose and crashed, great troughs of air barged from side to side across the blackened dome and shattered against one another. I ignored them, and I danced until I comprehended, not through my mind, but through my body. I would not, could not stop. I was free from inhibition, flamed by the sheer force of the duende that passed through the earth into my feet. The battlefield spilled downwards, and the bellowing engulfed the city, tearing at its fabric, demolishing everything that was frail or delicate, hammering at anything that stood up to it. But I did not stop. They could not stop me. And then the heavens split open, and for an awful moment I saw the staggering infinite depths of the universe. And there, measured against eternity, was my paper-thin mortality, my tiny passing of years, and my soul overwhelmed with a simple understanding. Roof tiles shattered on the paving stones, windows exploded, and flying glass shards nicked at Anna's flesh. The brothers were blind to their destruction, carelessly abandoning Sirona to its perdition. Anna stood at the centre of the chaos, and with each violent wind blast, she felt a fire burn more fiercely in her soul. She did not move, a steel statue in a tempest. Then the metal fractured, Anna's throat tore open, and from the chasm came the harshest of callings. No middle tone easy with song, but a brutal coal-black rupturing, a sound coarse enough to flay the moon. Darker and darker it went, passing below human register, down and until it reached the roofs of an un- and abused people, down further until it awoke the deep river of sleep. And upward it careered, through the night, piercing the heavens and stopping the winds in their tracks. Where the storm had raved, there was left only a massive silence, and in the quelled air, all sound was frozen. So, I guess we've got time for more questions. Another sort of maybe another 5 minutes or so. Yeah. I would say not in. I'm music. I am not someone. I mean, I like music, but I'm not a musical person. But the nearest experience I would say is I played soccer all my life, and there are certain moments, that you know, the great moments, when you are just so completely in the present. It's as though the air around you, the ball, the other players, everything is moving in slow motion and you have complete control. It happens rarely, but yes. And I imagine that music is similar to art in the sense that once you commit to the process, it's a dialogue. You start to put something out there and then it demands back to you as much of what it wants as you tell it. In other words, what you've put down has not only a natural course, but it has an echo and a calling. The way I see it, no matter what kind of artist you are, musician, writer, dancer, anything, that your job is to learn your craft in the broadest and best way you can. You put in your hard graft over 20, 30 years, whatever it takes, and then you let go. You give yourself over and you become a culvert. You grease the inside of the pipe as best you can and you begin anywhere. It almost doesn't matter. I begin my books in the middle. I begin with an image that suggests a word that suggests an image, and so I grow it outwards. And very quickly, it takes on a life of its own. So then my job is to trust it, to facilitate it, to bring my basic skills to bear on whatever the spirit of that piece is. I mean, I'm not the only one to speak this way. Michelangelo spoke about releasing the figures from the stone. Doris Lessing talks about cleaning the page so the words can be seen. There are many, many ways of describing it, feeling for it. But once you've been there, and you've even felt it for a tinge, you know that the ego-based art of the 20th century, the one that says, I am an artist, therefore what I produce has to be art, is bullshit. Complete and utter bullshit. In the same way as music, there is such a thing as a bum note. It's either on the note or it's not. Now, you may use sounds off of the note intentionally, but that's a conscious decision. But the same thing applies visually. And yet we bought hook, line, and sinker, the whole Emperor's New Clothes, in believing that if some git gets up and says, I'm an artist, therefore it's art, it is. There are certain visual truths. There is an aesthetic. That aesthetic is multi-headedly complex, from the construction of a shell to the spirals of the universe. It still is reliant on the golden mean at root. That balance that we use to make our judgment, whether that picture's straight or whether that feels right or whether we should move to the left or the right, it's all the same thing. First you ground yourself, you put yourself in a position of balance. Balance is not constant. Balance is about movement, constantly changing to the flow and sway of whatever it is you're creating or however it is you're living your life. It seems so obvious, but our culture, our base religion, maybe, if you call it that, whatever that is, and I use that in the broadest sense, whether it's a religion of dogma or whether it's a religion of consumption, It's still something that is trying to close you down. So I come back to where I started. For me, what all this is about is waking up. It's about, for me, on a daily, minute basis, I do what I do because this is what stops me from nodding off. Last one.
I have a couple of comments. I want to disagree with you on one.
Please do. I thank you, and that's if it's really, I want to just encourage people to work themselves. Ask questions. I don't give answers. I hope I provoke good thoughts. I do just want to end with just to give you some. I just want to make sure, look around to make sure she's not here, because this is this occurred in Denver a few years ago, and because it was a city, I have to repeat it. And it was my favorite question of all time because it caught me so off guard. I had a great evening. The questions had been really insightful. And I said, one more question. And there's a young woman in the front row. She put her hand up excitedly, and I said, yes. And she said, what's your favorite kind of meat? And being a surrealist at heart, and looking at her in her youth, all I could say was, nubile flesh. if you want to know anything more, go to nickbantock.com. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Alan Folsom, Chris Hedges, Kimberly Stewart, Sophie Kinsella, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on January 10th, 2007.